we are launching a new book, and books are really at the heart of what we do here at Brookings. You know, the think tank universe has expanded a lot just in the dozen years since our center was founded. There are probably, 6 or 8 think tanks around town that focus on the Middle East today, whereas when we started, there were really only 1 or 2. The media environment's changed, with the web putting a premium on instantaneous reactions to events, quick hit op-eds. And of course, the region that we study, the Middle East and North Africa, is undergoing such tremendous turmoil and uncertainty, it's enough to make your head spin trying to keep up with events. And it's in that kind of environment, that rapid-fire, dynamic environment, that I think the work that we do here at Brookings takes on added value. We focus on in-depth research. We examine the issues before us in context, in historical context, in comparative context. And over the longer term, we step back from the headlines to understand why things are the way they are. Not whose policy argument is winning the day today, but why our policy debates are so stuck and how to fix them. Not what will happen tomorrow, but what will happen in a year or 2 or 5 or 10. And I can tell you that there are some books that have been published by scholars at the Brookings Institution whose impact was not felt in the year or 2 or 5 after they were published. But when the policy environment was ripe, that smart thinking and those policy solutions were ready to go between two covers. And so at a time when the Middle East future is so uncertain and so anxiety-provoking, I find that fixating on instant reactions to every tiny trend doesn't bring us any greater clarity. In fact, it's likely to make us lose sight of the larger trajectory of events. And the larger trajectory of events in the Arab world today is dramatic enough. It's about a rejection of centralized corporatist control of society, of economics, of politics, in favor of empowerment at the individual level, the local, the community level. And in the process, the people of the Middle East and North Africa are debating new relationships between citizens and the state, between the state and society, between the state and religious institutions and religious authorities. And one of the biggest debates in the region today, one of the most heated and controversial, is over the place of religion in public life and of religious movements in politics. And that's why today is a special day for us, because today we are launching a new in-depth study of Islamist movements in the Arab world by our colleague Shadi Hamid. Now, Shadi began this work, the work that went into the book that I'm holding up now, Temptations of Power, Islamists and Illiberal Democracy in a New Middle East, for sale outside. Shadi started this well before the uprisings of 2011, and over the last several years, he's conducted literally hundreds of interviews with Islamist leaders, rank-and-file activists, to get a deep understanding of their thinking and of their choices as they confronted the unprecedented opportunities in newly opened political systems and as they dealt with the challenges that their participation in those systems presented to them. We've had a lot of debates over the last few years in this town and in the region about whether the Muslim Brotherhood is motivated fundamentally by ideology, by organizational politics, or by the quest to power. I think what Shadi's done in this book is to look beyond these sorts of dichotomous arguments and explain how groups like the Brotherhood combine features of political parties, features of religious movements, features of social movements, and to understand how these factors shape their actions and their choices. Now, that doesn't offer us an easy diagnosis, it doesn't offer us easy answers, but it does offer us understanding. And it's clear that Islamist movements will be an important factor in the future of Arab politics, whether they are elected, whether they are excluded, or whether they are boycotting and sitting on the sidelines. So understanding who they are, how they behave, and how these movements might evolve is very important to our understanding of the region's future. And that's why I'm so proud to have the chance to present this book. Now, Shadi, as you know, as many of you know, I think, was the director of research at our Brookings Doha Center for 4 years. He came back in January of this year to Brookings, Washington, to join our project on U.S. relations with the Islamic world, which is headed by its director, Will McCants. Shadi also worked and indeed helped found the Project on Middle East Democracy, which is a research and advocacy organization here in town that was working on these issues again well before the Arab Spring. And he was a Hewlett Fellow at Stanford in their Center for Democracy, Development, and the Rule of Law. We are really delighted that to join him in conversation about this book and about the issues that it raises, we have with us today Margaret Brennan. Margaret is a good friend and a correspondent, foreign policy correspondent at CBS News. She's been primarily assigned to the State Department and has put in a lot of miles following Secretary Clinton and now Secretary Kerry around the world covering national security and diplomatic issues. As a result, she has seen the events of the last few years in the Middle East up close and personal and has been a witness to the struggles of the U.S. government in adapting to these dynamic changes. And as a veteran of covering breaking news, I can think of no one better to help us explore the insights that are covered in Shadi's book. So with that, let me thank you again for being here and welcome Shadi up to the stage to give us a sense of the book. Thank you.
Hi, everyone. Thanks, Tamara, for the kind introduction. Thanks to all of you for coming. I'll just start off with some brief introductory remarks to kind of give you some context about the book and some of the key arguments, and then look forward to having a conversation with Margaret and then all of you in the question and answer session. So really, this book has been 10 years in the making. I started conducting field research on the Muslim Brotherhood in Jordan in 2004-2005. I lived in Amman for a year, and that's when I really became fascinated with these groups, the kind of internal struggles they were going through, the tensions between these absolute religious ideals and the mundane realities of everyday politics. And I wanted to really understand, what animates these groups, what drives them, and at the end of the day, what do they really want? And I remember I was a young, naive grad student at the time, and I would just go to the Muslim Brotherhood headquarters and just spend hours in the archives looking at documents and articles, and they were always a little bit confused. What is this guy doing? Why does he care about us so much? And that was at a time when this topic wasn't that hot, and especially when it came to Jordan, it wasn't very often that a Western researcher would spend months and months studying the Muslim Brotherhood in Jordan. What I think is really important, and I kind of just mentioned this because we don't have to like Islamists, but I do think we have to understand them. And that's what I've really tried to do in my research, and I've tried to reflect that in my book, to immerse myself to some extent in their world, to understand their worldview. Now, let me just start off with a quote from Mohamed Morsi. So the first time I met with ex-president Mohamed Morsi was on May 8, 2010. And this was at a very difficult time for the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt. Repression was getting worse. It was intensifying. The Muslim Brotherhood was being pushed out of the political process. Parliamentary elections were coming up, and everyone just assumed that the Brotherhood would go down from 88 seats to something very low, and ultimately they won zero seats in the last election before the Arab uprisings began. So this was in May 2010. So Morsi We're sitting down and he tells me this. So the context is he's telling me that he doesn't like it when the Muslim Brotherhood is called an opposition party. So he said, the word opposition has the connotation of seeking power. But at this moment, we are not seeking power because that requires preparation and society is not prepared. And it's just kind of interesting to look back because that was just 7 months before the January 25th revolution and Mubarak's fall. So that kind of gives you the mindset that a lot of Islamists were in before all of this happened. They were very cautious, very gradualist, and they were looking years, if not decades, into the future. They knew their moment, they thought their moment wouldn't come anytime soon. And what I try to do in this book is look at these two distinctive phases in the Islamist experience. So before the Arab uprisings and after, or another way of looking at it, under repression, intensifying repression under the Mubarak regime, and in Jordan we also see a closing of political space as well. That's one phase, and then looking at how Islamists had to adapt very quickly and try to respond to the democratic openings made possible by the Arab revolts. And you see different sides of the Islamist personality in these different phases. Now, let's start with under repression. So one of the arguments I make in the book is, contrary to the academic and conventional wisdom, repression, rather than having a radicalizing effect, actually forced mainstream Islamist movements to become more moderate over time. And when I say more moderate, I have several indicators that I focus on, including embracing various tenets of democratic life, alternation of power, popular sovereignty, reaching out to liberal and leftist actors, also evolving on sensitive issues like women's rights and protection of minorities. You see an evolution in Islamist thinking and practice in the 1990s and 2000s. I won't go into kind of the causal, I try to specify in the book what are the causal factors that resulted in repression having this moderating effect on Islamist groups. But essentially, as political space closes in countries like Egypt and Jordan, during that same time, the Muslim Brotherhood in both countries doubles down on its democratic discourse, de-emphasizes Sharia law, reaches out more than ever to liberal and leftist groups, forms cross-ideological coalitions. So that was one of the questions I was trying to address in the book. This seems counterintuitive, but we do see those two things going together, repression and a commitment to moderate positions and policies. Now, the flip side of this is what happens when there's a democratic opening. And I would say here that much of the academic literature posits that the more you include Islamists in a democratic process, the more moderate they'll become. Makes sense. It's intuitive. And actually, it's not just the academic literature. It's reached the highest levels of policymaking as well. And George, when I was writing the book, I came across a quote that I'm not sure some of you might remember it from 2005. George W. Bush was responding to a question about Hezbollah and its role in Lebanese politics. So George W. says this, I like the idea of people running for office. There's a positive effect. Maybe some will run for office and say, vote for me. I look forward to blowing up America. But I don't think so. I think people who generally run for office say, vote for me. I'm looking forward to fixing your potholes, also known as kind of the pothole theory of democracy. But but what I found in my research was a little bit different. During brief democratic openings in Egypt and Jordan, so in Egypt in the mid-1980s and Jordan from 1989 until about 1992, we see brief democratic openings, but during that time, Islamists actually put Islamic law and the implementation of Islamic law front and center. They try to pass Islamic legislation in parliament. Their discourse is very focused on this, and in some ways you can even look at them as a kind of Sharia lobby. They're very focused on the role of religion instead of having a broader national agenda. Now, this kind of also extends to the post-Arab Spring period, and what we see is democratization in a country like Egypt, again, pushing Islamists further to the right. And there's a number of reasons for that. I'll just mention a couple of them, but I think this is important because sometimes we as Americans, we think that good things go together. Democracy, moderation, that once you open up these, open up political space, these political parties are going to change. You're going to move on this linear projection towards moderation, pluralism, and all the things that we like and want to see. But I really want to problematize that notion. And one reason is, under oppression, your base gives you a lot of latitude. It's all about survival, so you don't have to really, you don't really have to focus as much on Islamic law or be very clear about your ideological vision, because you're probably not coming to power anytime soon. But when you do, when there is a political opening and you do have a chance to come to power, your base wants you to deliver. And much of your conservative base voted for you because you're Islamist. So you have to show that you're moving in that direction. It's also an issue of responding to popular sentiment. These are, at least, certainly Egypt and many other societies to a lesser extent, are deeply conservative when it comes to how they view the role of religion in public life. And I'll just give you one very quick example of that. There was a Pew poll from 2011 where, it's really remarkable numbers, where 80% of Egyptian respondents said they believed in stoning for the crime of adultery. 70% believed in cutting off the hands of thieves. And 88% supported the death penalty for apostasy, i.e. leaving the religion of Islam. So even if we take this poll as an outlier, you cut off 20%, that's still a large segment of the population that wants to see more Islam in public life, not less. And if there's a demand for this, then someone has to supply it, right? And that's why Islamists actually come under a lot of pressure to show that they're respecting that kind of Islamic sentiment. And that's why we see, you know, in Morsi's election and afterwards, a lot, you know, a lot more of this Islamist rhetoric and moving towards the Salafis. And I just, and I'll mention that too, because that's a very important part of this, that with the opening of democratic space, it's not just the Muslim Brotherhood. It's not just the mainstream Islamists. You have ultra-conservative Salafis on the right flank, and this leads to a Tea Party effect, where the far right drags mainstream Islamists further in that direction. And this isn't unique to the Middle East, and that's why I refer to it as a Tea Party effect. It happens here in this country. We see examples of this in established democracies in Europe. But this is especially the case when you have deeply polarized societies. So the center doesn't really hold. You have Islamists, you have non-Islamists, they generally don't like each other, and the center, the political center, is weak, it has trouble establishing itself. So then if you're an ideological party, you ask yourself, well, what's the point of moving to the center if there's no one there? What's the point of doing that if there aren't many independent voters? Will I be able to convince secular voters to vote for me when they already have this ideological objection to our program as an Islamist party? And I think we see a little bit of this in a country like Turkey, where over time Erdogan has moved, Prime Minister Erdogan has moved further to the right, and in some sense it's worked for him. He's doubled down on his conservative base, and he actually, the ruling party, increased its share in local elections from 39% in 2009 to 45% just on March 30th, the other week. So rallying the base can actually work in the narrow sense of, you know, of political victories, electoral victories. Now, I'll just kind of close here so one of the questions I raise in the second half of the book in particular is, what if Arabs, or really anyone, what if Arabs decide that through the democratic process that they don't want to be liberals? And this is where I get to the tensions between liberalism and democracy. If you have majorities that want to see a stricter implementation of Islamic law, or at least more Islamic law, whatever that means, then do Arabs or do Egyptians or Jordanians, do they have the right to try out an alternative ideological project? So they're not, I mean, and Islamists are not going to become liberals anytime soon, perhaps ever, because they aren't liberal. They're Islamists for a reason. So unlike other illiberal political leaders, whether it's people like, you know, Chavez, these kinds of populist leaders, illiberalism, I argue, isn't really intrinsic to their ideology. For them, it's more about consolidation of power. But with Islamists, illiberalism is central to their ideology. They don't want to be liberal. They're not supposed to be liberal. So I would just kind of end here by posing this question. I think it's something really worth thinking about. What are the limits of democratic politics? How far can these societies go if Islamists keep on winning elections? Now, that won't happen anytime soon in a place like Egypt, but at some point we're going to have to revisit this debate of if Islamists keep on doing well in elections in a particular country, and Tunisia could be an example of this, and they pursue more Islamization, how far is that going to go? And obviously there's going to be a lot of opposition to that. Thank you.
Hello, everyone. Sorry for the delay there. Were there technical preparations so you can all hear us? I'm Margaret Brennan from CBS, and you just heard Shadi lay out some of his thought process and some of his themes from this book, Temptations of Power. And I've been following Shadi's work for some time now, and actually came to know him quite well in 2011 during the uprisings. And in fact, we were in Tahrir Square together the night that Hosni Mubarak fell. I was with another network at the time, but turned to Shadi for analysis of what was this all going to mean. And in thinking back, when I was talking to you the other day, I remembered that while there was all this jubilation, I mean, chanting, fireworks, this party basically in the streets and the world watching, you were a little bit of a Debbie Downer. You were like, this is not over. This is just beginning. And you were talking at that time, that day, about what was going to be coming to the fore with the Muslim Brotherhood and raising concerns. Why did you foresee the importance there? I mean, why did you at that time, when people weren't necessarily sure how things were going to shake out, say, these guys who no one was voting for, Mohamed Morsi himself 7 months prior said he had no idea they were going to be ruling anything anytime soon. Why did you think there was a shot?
Yeah, well, I think so. We were there, and so we were in the square when the announcement was made, and you know, the crowd just buzzed. There was this kind of euphoria, and you know, it was hard not to get caught up in that. And I think all of us were affected by that, and maybe that led us to be more optimistic than we otherwise should have been. But you know, at that time, first of all, democratic transitions are always difficult. They're always uncertain. So even in the best case scenario for a country like Egypt, it was going to be very messy. And I think we kind of lost sight that these are difficult, long processes, especially in countries that have, you know, lower levels of economic development, considerable ideological polarization. And I think focusing on the role of Islamists was important at that time because, I mean, historically, Islamists have provoked a lot of anti-democratic reactions from an array of actors. So whether it's the Egyptian military, the deep state, secularists, liberals, I mean, even under the Mubarak regime, they were cooperating more together, but there was this fundamental distrust. They would work together, but liberals would always be suspicious of the Muslim Brotherhood. What do they really want? Are they just kind of using us? And vice versa. The Muslim Brotherhood would be very critical of liberals at that time, saying, well, they support Mubarak. They're not doing enough to oppose Mubarak. Why aren't they being more forthright in their support of democracy? So, you know, in some ways, repression brought them closer together. But once you remove that, then they have to contend with each other. And you had this brief moment of unity in Tahrir Square. And what was so amazing about it was you had liberals, leftists, young revolutionaries, Muslim Brotherhood. The Muslim Brotherhood had a real presence in Tahrir Square after January 28th, but you also had a lot of Salafis. And I wondered at the time, why aren't people focusing on that part of it? Because I remember being in Tahrir Square towards the end there were a lot of Salafis. Yeah. You know, but the great thing about it at the time was they put all the ideological disagreements aside and they said, we have one goal, it's to bring down Mubarak, and that's what we're going to do. But once Mubarak fell, then they started to turn against each other. There was a brief moment, maybe three or four months after Mubarak fell, where there was a lot of talk about a grand coalition, national unity, and all of that. But as the process went forward, liberals and Islamists in particular started to realize that they really do disagree on fundamental issues. It's not just about power and politics. It's also about a different vision for their country, how they view the state, the identity of the state, the role of religion in public life. And these are very raw existential issues, understandably.
But so what you described in terms of the pothole theory from the Bush years really didn't expire with the Bush years. In many ways, that was the working thesis for the U.S. government, which was the mundane act of governing will make people moderate because it's hard to get people to collect the trash from the streets and have trains run on time and be more than a party in opposition, have something more than just an ideology. Did the Muslim Brotherhood walk away from this coup that just happened, where they had their shot in power and now have been jailed and arguably some would say more than just pushed to the side? Right. I mean, Morsi hasn't really been seen publicly since right. He was removed from office. Have they learned a lesson? And has there been a lesson sort of projected out to some of the other Islamist parties about we need to be more than an ideology?
Yeah. So I think there's a lot of internal discussions within the Muslim Brotherhood about tactics. Could they have done certain things differently at certain times? And I think one of the major sentiments I hear from Brotherhood contacts now is we should have been more revolutionary. When Morsi came to power in August 2012, we should have moved more aggressively, not less, against the deep state, against the military. But in terms of a more fundamental ideological revision, I don't think we're seeing that yet. I mean, we'll have to wait and see.
But could they have actually done that? I mean, that's looking back. Did they have any ability to be revolutionary? I mean, you're saying Morsi 7 months prior was basically saying, hey, we're an idea.
They couldn't have been revolutionary because that's not the nature of mainstream Islamist organizations. They're fundamentally gradualist. They see things in a very long-term time horizon. They don't want to do things right away. They're slow and steady. And this is why, you know, Morsi's approach was in some ways about accommodating, trying to accommodate the deep state, trying to accommodate the military. That's what the Brotherhood does best. It kind of cuts deals and makes compromises when it comes to the give and take of political power. But for a variety of reasons, that approach didn't work. They didn't do a very good job of it. And by focusing so much on the military and trying to neutralize the military, they forgot about their revolutionary allies and the liberals who supported them when Morsi was in the second round of elections against Ahmed Shafiq. So, they can't, and I don't think, this is going to be one of the key tensions, I think, in the organization now. You have this younger rank and file in Egypt that is going protesting every day, every week, and they have this attitude of, we need to destroy the state. It's not just the military, it's not just Sisi, it's the whole state structure. But then you have the Brotherhood in exile, mostly based in Doha, Istanbul, and London, and they're still speaking in the language of political processes, reinstating Morsi, reinstating the constitution, electoral legitimacy. So you're seeing a kind of disconnect between the Brotherhood leadership and the rank and file who are saying, you old leaders, you're not in the spirit of the revolution. And they're very paranoid that the leadership abroad is going to sell them out and cut some deal in a couple years with whoever happens to be in power. So I think we're going to see that tension.
Well, now in Egypt, because you are seeing a lot of tension. I mean, with how the Muslim Brotherhood is being treated, there's either, if you believe one party, you think they're going to be turned into an insurgency. You've said maybe, maybe not. I mean, you're talking about your context getting more revolutionary, at least in what they're saying out loud. Or you think maybe you're making them more moderate once again.
Yeah.
How do you think Egypt now is going to play out in terms of your theories and your themes?
Yeah. So I make a distinction in the book between different levels of repression. Not all repression is the same. And under the Mubarak regime, there was growing repression, but there was never an attempt to eradicate the Muslim Brotherhood altogether. There was a closing of space in Jordan, and Islamists were increasingly marginalized, but King Abdullah never tried, or never wanted to, I should say, destroy the Muslim Brotherhood there either. What I think is fundamentally different about the situation in Egypt today is there is a concerted effort to not just limit or marginalize the Muslim Brotherhood, but to eradicate it altogether. And that's a different level of repression. So extreme levels of repression are bound to have some radicalizing effect. And I make that distinction in the book. And, you know, we see an example of that, for example, in Algeria, where you have extreme levels of repression in the 1990s. And you do see elements of the mainstream opposition turning to violence. Now, the Brotherhood is different as an organization, so I don't think there's going to be that much radicalization as there was in, say, Algeria, because the organization, you know, has had a long commitment to nonviolence. And any Muslim Brotherhood member grows up in the organization, goes through an educational curriculum where it's all about slow, gradual change. Violence is not the answer. It hasn't worked in the past. And that's something that every Muslim Brotherhood member is kind of immersed in. And there's also this aspect of deference to the leadership. It's a hierarchical organization. So if the murshid or the general guide or other top leaders say, stick to nonviolence, they would really have to go against the leadership in a way that isn't very common within the Muslim Brotherhood. That said, we are already seeing a minority of Muslim Brotherhood members who are turning to some degree of violence, and it could even be low-level violence in this case, Molotov cocktails, burning police cars, attacking police officers, this more kind of anarchic approach to violence. So you are going to see a minority moving in that direction, but I don't think you're going to see any kind of mass organizational shift to violence. That said, even if you have a minority in an organization of hundreds of thousands of people, that can still have an incredibly destabilizing effect. So, 2% of, you know, a 500,000 strong organization is still a significant number of people who can really cause instability in Egypt.
Today, the State Department sanctioned Ansar Beit al-Maqdis. They said that this organization is a terrorist group, and they've staged attacks on tourists and on Israel. But in Egypt, they haven't done that yet. They haven't called them terrorists yet, officially. That decision's supposed to be coming. But there has been, at least in conversation, talk about linking the two. Do you see groups that the United States would consider terror groups having legitimate ties to the Muslim Brotherhood, as some have alleged, in Egypt right now?
Yeah, that's certainly the narrative that you hear from the Egyptian government and certainly the Egyptian media.
Spin? Or is it real?
Well, yeah, it's spin. I mean, there's no evidence. And this is the question we pose sometimes to, you know, Egyptian friends and colleagues. You know, we're open to considering that if there is evidence. But up until now, there has been no evidence that the Muslim Brotherhood is joining Ansar Beit al-Maqdis or is part of the low-level insurgency in the Sinai, or that it was responsible, as some in the Egyptian government alleged, for the Mansoura bombing the other month. There just simply isn't evidence of that. But it is working as a delegitimizing the Brotherhood in Egypt. So people are very sensitive about terrorism. They're having unprecedented insecurity in major cities. I mean, to have it extending from the Sinai into major urban centers, that's something Egyptians haven't seen in quite some time. So the government knows that people are very concerned about their security, and they want to tie the Brotherhood to that to further keep this popular sentiment against them.
Will it work?
Will it work? Well, in some ways, it has already worked. And I think if you look at previous periods of repression, so you had Gamal Abdel Nasser in the 1950s and 60s. The Brotherhood was pretty much wiped out from the public political sphere. But there was a real difference there. There wasn't a kind of popular sentiment that was turning against the Brotherhood, where you had millions of Egyptians saying, Nasser, we want you to kill the Brotherhood. There might have been some of that, but not to the extent that we're seeing today. And that's what I think is so frightening about the direction that Egypt is going. It's not just a dictator who's killing people. He has real popular support from ordinary Egyptians. We don't know how big that segment of the population is.
You're talking about Sisi.
Yeah, support for Sisi, support for the military, support for a very hard line against the Muslim Brotherhood. So whatever that segment of the population is, we can say safely, we're talking about many millions of Egyptians who passionately support the new order and want to see the Muslim Brotherhood destroyed. So that's going to make it, I think, more challenging for the Brotherhood to recover, or recover as quickly this time, because there are a lot of Egyptians, for a variety of reasons, who very much dislike or even hate the Brotherhood. And I saw this firsthand when I was in Egypt right before the Rabah massacre of August 14th. I was there a couple days before. And it's just amazing to kind of talk to your friends, people that you care about, people that you respect, who are, you know, liberal or Western educated. And they're telling you straight to your face, you know, we want the military. Why isn't the military being more brutal against the Brotherhood? We want to see them wiped out. We want, you know, people calling openly and publicly for a massacre. I mean, that's remarkable, and that's what I think is very troubling, that you see people, because usually when you want to kill people, you feel kind of like shameful about it. I shouldn't be too straight up about it, usually. But I think what's frightening is that people were saying this openly without shame.
Were you trying out your theories on them, saying no, that'll make them stronger if you repress them? How did that go over?
Well, so that's the thing. I mean, the Brotherhood has been able to bounce back historically from periods of repression. But I think what some would argue is we have to get it right this time. Mm-hmm. The repression has to be more intense than it ever was before, because this is the chance to deliver the Brotherhood the final decisive blow. And I think this is an illusion. Because even if you look at places where you have that, you know, full spectrum eradication. So in Syria, for example, in the 1980s, where the Muslim Brotherhood, membership in the Muslim Brotherhood was made punishable by death. So even being just a member could get you a death sentence. And the Brotherhood disappeared from the Syrian public sphere. So there was the illusion that the Syrian Muslim Brotherhood had been eradicated. But once you see a political opening, so in 2011, you see the Syrian Muslim Brotherhood bouncing back rather quickly. They might not be the strongest political force in the country, but they're certainly one of the strongest and most influential political forces in the country. So I think that tells us something. We always have these obituaries of political Islam every 5 or 10 years. But political Islam and the Muslim Brotherhood specifically is not just, it's not just an organization, it's also an idea. Mm-hmm. And it's very difficult to kill ideas.
Mm-hmm. And that may be one of the reasons why some of the policy prescriptions are so challenging, particularly in places, you know, like the Pentagon, like the State Department right now, and they're trying to figure out how to respond and how to handle this. I remember being in a year after, I guess, you and I were in Tahrir, a little less than that. We were in Alexandria. I was there with then Secretary Clinton, and the press corps and the motorcade were quite surprised to have all sorts of food and water and things thrown at us. Protesters in the streets very upset that she was there to meet Mohamed Morsi, the first high-ranking official to do so. There was anger about the U.S. response, and that was not really what anyone expected within policy circles, at least on that trip. Do you think that the U.S. has a better sense now of what's happening on the ground and how the public is reacting to the now governing bodies?
Yeah, so that Clinton trip was interesting because That's where you really start to see more of these conspiracy theories about the U.S. working mm-hmm. with the Muslim Brotherhood in this grand conspiracy to destabilize Egypt, that Secretary Clinton and her colleagues were trying to, you know, push the election in Morsi's favor, even though Ahmed Shafiq really won. And you were hearing this from people that we would have thought would be more under, you know, people who are at least a little bit more pro-American than, say, Islamists are, the liberals of Egypt. So liberals started to really see this so-called Muslim Brotherhood American alliance. The problem is now, if you look at the Egyptian public discourse, liberals still think that the U.S. is still sympathetic to the Brotherhood. Maybe they want to help the Brotherhood get back into the political process somehow. But then you hear on the other side, the Muslim Brotherhood, for I think understandable reasons, feels betrayed by the U.S. From their perspective, they feel that the U.S. could have stopped the coup, or at least after the coup, could have taken a stronger stand and put more pressure on the on Sisi and other military officials. So we've managed to alienate both sides of the Egyptian divide almost equally. In a sense, they both have a very strong dislike for the U.S. because of what they see as American support for whoever their opponent is. So that's going to take a very long time to rebuild trust with whether it's Islamist liberals. It's going to take a long time, and we have to rethink our strategy. And I think part of the problem was American policy was never clear. We never explained, you know, there was this, I think, tendency to try to split the middle, that, you know, we don't want to go too much in this direction, too much in that. And that led to a lot of confusion about what U.S. policy really was. And this was a question that I would get not just in Egypt, but across the region when I was living in the Gulf. People would say, oh, we strongly dislike American policy. But then they would ask me in the same breath, what exactly is American policy? So it's kind of funny that they had a very strong dislike for a policy they didn't truly understand, or, you know, they didn't know what Obama really wanted. And there was always that kind of confusion.
You talk a little bit in the book about sort of the need to have opposition to the U.S. or sort of the West more broadly in some way. Can you explain that?
Well, sure. I mean, you know, if you're running in an election, anti-Americanism can be an effective mobilizing tool. And this has been used time and time again, not just by Islamists, but also liberals and leftists. Mm-hmm. I mean, anti-Americanism is one of the very few things that unites everyone in the Egyptian political spectrum. So one thing they can agree on is that for whatever reason, we don't like the U.S., and so on. But this kind of gets us to a bigger problem when you have democratic openings, when you have an electoral process. If you're having trouble delivering on basic things, if you don't have a clear way to fix the potholes, and fixing the potholes in a place like Egypt would be a very challenging venture. So it's easier then to fall back on things that you know are going to have appeal with the broader population. So you resort to religion, ideology, anti-Americanism, xenophobia, nationalism, whatever it happens to be. And we're seeing something similar now where you have this rise of hyper-nationalism among the supporters of Field Marshal Sisi, this very kind of aggressive nationalism. And that's a way to get people mobilized. And that's the kind of dark side, or let's say one of the darker undercurrents of democratization. It, you know, and especially in countries where you don't have a clear economic, no one has a clear economic program, and I think this is important. Everyone kind of says the same thing on the economy, that the free market is good when it does good things, and social protections are good when they protect people. So very vague sloganeering that they, you know, a mixture of free market and social protections. And there isn't a lot of variation when you look at the political program, the economic programs of these different parties. So talking about the economy isn't going to sell because everyone is saying essentially the same thing. We want to fight poverty. We want to combat unemployment. So the only way to really distinguish yourself from your competitors in the electoral process is to find out what makes you different. So for Islamists, they're different because they're Islamists. For Salafis, it's because they're more Islamist than the mainstream Islamists. For liberals, it's because they feel that Islamists are a fundamental existential threat to the country, and they want to mobilize people around a kind of fear or opposition to the rise of Islamists. So unfortunately,
the way these political systems have evolved, not just in Egypt, but in many countries in the region, the left and right is very much based on religion and ideology and not so much on economic programs.
You mentioned in your remarks a little bit about Turkey, but more broadly, do you think that this sort of working theory on illiberal democracy applies outside the Arab world to the Muslim world, but not necessarily specific to Arab society?
Yeah, certainly. And I think Turkey is a really interesting example of this. That
there's not a cultural component necessarily.
No, not necessarily. I think in some ways the polarization is more challenging to address in the Arab world for a variety of reasons. I mean, at least Turkey, everyone is still agreeing to participate within the political process. You don't have people calling, for the most part, calling for military coups anymore. So as polarized as Turkey is getting, there are still rules of the game. And that's why it's still possible to be somewhat optimistic about Turkey in the longer run, that as long as they keep the process somewhat intact. But even if you go further afield, in a place like Malaysia, which while it's not a democracy, you do have a certain level of democratic competition. What's really interesting is that the ruling party is ostensibly secular, UMNO. And the ruling secular party is becoming more Islamized in its rhetoric. And it's trying to outbid the major opposition, the major Islamist opposition party PAS. And they're competing to see who can be more Islamist, who can use the most aggressively Islamic rhetoric.
Why is that?
Well, because if you have a conservative society, and while Malaysia is 60% Muslim, but among that 60%, you have, a lot of religious conservatism, and people respond to appeals to religion. So the ruling party feels that it can peel off voters from the Islamists if they use that same kind of language. And again, it's a way to rally support, because even if you support a secular party, you can still be religious. You still might identify with religious rhetoric. So these parties have found creative ways to use that to their advantage, instrumentalizing rhetoric for their electoral operation.
But what you're talking about in terms of demographics isn't necessarily new. What's the common catalyst? Is there one?
Common catalyst?
To then act on your religious conviction. Why the drive? Why the trigger in Malaysia and elsewhere?
Well, I would just kind of say just more generally on this is, part of what I want to do in this book is bring ideology back into the conversation. It's not just about responding to your conservative base. It's not just about voter mobilization. Islamists actually do believe what they say they believe. And we have to take it seriously because it's something honestly felt. Again, we don't have to like it, but we have to take it seriously in the realm of ideas. Islamists actually do have a different way of looking at the world than many non-Islamists do, and certainly than secularists do. And it comes to very, as I mentioned earlier, very basic things. The identity of the Egyptian state, the meaning of the nation state, and there isn't consensus around those basic things, and Islamists want to take things in a different direction. And there's a number of examples, and we kind of hypothesize, if Morsi stayed in power for 5 years or 10 years, we can kind of think about what are the kinds of measures that he'd likely pursue after he was able to secure himself in power. So it's not just about instrumentalization. People say, well, the Brotherhood is always using religion for political ends, but they're also using politics for religious ends. It goes both ways.
Mm-hmm. So when you're through with all this research and perhaps sitting back in a few months when you've recovered from writing this,
right.
Is there a policy prescription that comes out of it? Or is this just you need to understand it, digest it, and that's it? I mean, If you're saying just accept it as part of the reality, are you basically saying that any Islamist party is going to view democracy as a one-way ticket to power? That's the end of the story.
Well, I'm not quite saying they see democracy as a one-way ticket to power. I do think that there is a legitimate commitment among most mainstream Islamist groups to the democratic process. I don't buy this one person, one vote, one time thing. And there's actually never been a real instance where Islamist parties come to power through democratic elections and cancel elections altogether. I don't, unless I'm missing one, it hasn't happened. Now, part of that is because they haven't actually been, you could argue, they haven't actually had a lot of chances to govern, but we're still stuck in this speculative argument about what would Islamists do, and at some point, they're going to have to govern for a period of time so we can put this to rest. I mean, otherwise this will be an endless conflict in these countries where Islamists are always blocked from political power and you have this kind of cycle of conflict, violence, and polarization.
But in your projection of the what if Morsi had stayed in power, can you see that playing out in terms of elections regularly scheduled actually being acted and having transitions to new democratically elected leaders?
Well, I think in this sense, you would have a kind of classic case of illiberal democracy where Morsi or the Muslim Brotherhood would put the focus primarily on procedures and elections, and the opposition would still have a chance to contest elections and push the Brotherhood out of power. But I think we already saw some of it in his 1 year in power. These initial efforts to limit dissent or to put pressure on his opponents. And we see that in Turkey right now with Erdogan, again, treating his opponents not as adversaries but as enemies. Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, that's always a risk in these early transitional phases. Now, to get to your question about the policy prescription, I think that the U.S. has to think more creatively and seriously about how they want to engage Islamist parties. And it's not just about the coming months in Egypt, but also thinking long term, because if we accept that political Islam is not going to die and disappear, then it's fair to assume that 5 years, 10 years, 15 years down the road in a place like Egypt, there will be at least some kind of political opening, and Islamists, and the Muslim Brotherhood in particular, will return to the political arena. Do we really want to kind of start from scratch each time and not learn from the lessons of the past? So I think for policymakers to develop a more effective strategy, they have to first at least understand Islamists. And that's where I think a book like this can be useful, is who are they, what are they about? That's step one. But also in terms of more specific policy prescriptions, I think one of the problems is that the U.S. did not engage with Islamist parties in a really meaningful way, especially in Egypt, before the Arab Spring. Mm-hmm. So we were kind of caught off guard, and we had to build a lot of those relationships from scratch after Mubarak fell. And that's why I think when Morsi was in power, there was a lot of miscommunication, a lot of misunderstanding between the two sides, is because they didn't trust each other, they didn't understand each other, and certain things that the American side would do would be perceived in a very different way by the Muslim Brotherhood, which is historically quite paranoid. Mm-hmm. And they were very paranoid during Morsi's 1 year in power. So if we're thinking, you know, 10 years down the road, or even if we look at an Islamist party that will likely be in power soon, again, in Tunisia, the main Islamist party there, Ennahda, when they come to power, we should think about how we can build a better relationship with them so we help support the transition process in that country. And part of that is based on dialogue and trust and building that over time.
I want to get to some of the questions in the audience. So if you would just raise your hand, we'll bring a microphone to you and just say your name, your organization. We'll start right there in the back.
Thanks very much. I'm Tom Porteous from Human Rights Watch, and congratulations on your book. You've been talking about, you know, two key players in this whole sort of political process, the regime on the one hand, and the Islamists on the other, the Muslim Brotherhood in particular in Egypt. But there's obviously, you know, there's a third very important player, which is actually the player that created the opening in the first place, the young activists who, you know, went into Tahrir Square, the pro-human rights groups, whatever you want to call them. I wouldn't call them necessarily secular liberals, but nonetheless, yeah. You know, they're just a sort of convenient label. What about them? They have been the targets of probably almost as much repression as the Muslim Brotherhood in recent months. The repression started, obviously, in July with a focus very much on the Brotherhood, but then it's kind of broadened out, and you've got a really appalling situation with the Egyptian media, with NGOs and human rights groups, people feeling very much under pressure. How can the how can that group be nurtured, be helped in order sometime in the future to be part of the solution?
Sure. So it's actually a little bit ironic that many of these young activists actually supported the military coup on July 3rd. And then many of them, or at least a growing number of them now, have not recanted, but have revised their opinions somewhat. And they realize now that it didn't quite work out the way they wanted to. But, and some of you may have seen the documentary, The Square, where you see some of these young activists who kind of drew a equivalence between Mubarak and Morsi and saw unseating Morsi by any means necessary, even a military coup, as part, as a continuation of the revolutionary spirit, if you will. Now, so some of them are actually still supporting this new order, but yes, many of them are kind of stuck in the middle, and they're trying to find their place politically now. It's very hard to devise political strategy when you're focusing on trying to get your friends out of prison. So for them, there isn't this kind of grand approach of how to bring down the regime. It's really just about survival. It's about trying bit by bit to get certain people released, to speak out about the most prominent arrests of Ahmed Maher, Ala, Abdel Fattah, these other people. I think one of the key questions going forward is to what extent, I mean, historically, it's very difficult to fight against repression or to unseat an authoritarian regime if the opposition is divided. And now the opposition is very much divided in Egypt. You have Islamists on one hand, and you have the non-Islamists. And they're not cooperating because there still is very much this distrust. And also, the Muslim Brotherhood is toxic. If you get accused of cooperating with the Muslim Brotherhood, you'll probably get more jail time than you otherwise would. So going forward, the key challenge for the opposition is, can they actually get their act together and start cooperating like they did in the final years of the Mubarak regime? But that will probably take time.
Right here with the pink jacket, salmon jacket.
Thank you. Bassam Omani, University of Waterloo. Thanks, Shadi. That was very interesting. I'm wondering about if you could just give us some insight, perhaps not in the purview of your book, but I'm sure you've come across this, the relationship between the Brotherhood and the Salafists or the Nur Party. Mm-hmm. And specifically, and I hope you don't refer to just the sort of the regional politics as an explanation, but really how do the Salafists really view what happened to the Brotherhood and how did the Brotherhood view the role of the Salafists when they were in government? I'd really love your insight into sort of how it was on the inside. Thank you.
So everyone was caught a little bit by surprise, at least, when the Salafi coalition in the parliamentary elections after Mubarak fell, it won 28% of the popular vote. I mean, just think about that for a second. These are groups that weren't generally politically active under Mubarak or not in a very serious way, and very quickly they were able to build popular support and do very, very well. And I remember in the lead up to those elections, the Brotherhood always kind of talked about Salafis like the younger little brother that kind of, you know, messes up the room and then mom has to come in. I mean, that sort of thing. Those Salafis, they don't know what, they say the wrong things, they embarrass us, they give political Islam a bad name. Some of you might recall when the Brotherhood Speaker of Parliament had to essentially shout down a Salafi member of Parliament who was trying to do the call to prayer in Parliament. And it was a kind of funny, amusing, and somewhat depressing exchange. But that kind of showed you the tension, because ultimately they were competing for many of the same voters. And even in the last months of Morsi's 1 year in power, and I remember I had some very interesting conversations with Brotherhood leaders in April, so 2 months before the coup. And they were so dismissive of liberals and leftists. Oh, they don't have any constituency. These people are nothing. But they were concerned about Salafis. And they would say, our main opposition are the Salafis, not the liberals. And essentially the message they were trying to send is, be careful what you wish for, because the alternative to us aren't nice, fluffy liberals, but actually more conservative Islamists. Now, so there was this real sense of competition, and that's continued until the present day, where some Salafis including the Noor Party, the largest Salafi party, supported the coup and have still been supporting the regime and supporting Sisi to some extent. So there's a real sense on the part of the Brotherhood that the Noor Party has betrayed the Islamic cause, and some of the worst language they use it's reserved for the Salafis, because it's one thing, they don't have high expectations of secularists and kind of look down on them anyway, but they're Salafis, they're supposed to be men of religion, they claim to believe in the Islamic project, but here they are being hypocrites essentially, and hypocrites is a very kind of negative idea in the Islamic tradition, people who claim one thing but actually do another. That's going to be very interesting to watch. That said, there are Salafis who have joined the Muslim Brotherhood as part of the anti-coup alliance. So it's not just the Brotherhood that, and this goes for also in Doha and Istanbul, you have Brotherhood leaders, but you also have Salafis who are based out of exile there as well.
Up here in front.
Hi, I'm Fred Altman, and I'm wondering, what is the potential for economic development in Egypt or the other countries, and what effect is that likely to have on the political process?
The state of economic development right now?
What do you project are the chances of any economic development?
Yeah, so I think one of the lessons of the last couple of years is that you can't separate the political from the economic. Mm-hmm. If there isn't political stability, the economy is never going to recover to the extent that it should. And it's tough for the economy to get back on track where you have daily or weekly protests, especially outside the urban centers on a very regular basis. You have a significant portion of the Egyptian population which doesn't recognize the legitimacy of the state. They're totally pushed out of the entire political process. So I think it's an illusion to think that you can ever have political stability as long as 20 or 30% of the population is totally cut out. And I think the problem is the Muslim Brotherhood has no incentive now to play a constructive role. And effectively, they wouldn't say this explicitly, but essentially what they're counting on right now is making Egypt as ungovernable as possible, a kind of indirect economic sabotage, that if they can protest, continue to kind of cause difficulties for the new military regime, that will kind of push people to oppose the regime more, and people will start to realize, oh, maybe the Muslim Brotherhood wasn't so bad after all, because our economic situation isn't getting better. Our security situation isn't getting better. And under Sisi, Sisi claims to be the kind of purveyor of stability, but actually he's presided over one of the most unstable periods in Egyptian history.
Why don't we do these two questions here? Sorry, the mic's getting jogged up to you right now. Just give us a sec.
Hi, Shadi, and thank you. Kent Davis-Packard, Council on Foreign Relations and visiting fellow at the Saban Center. I just got back from Egypt, as you know, and when I spoke with the Islamists there, they said something very interesting, which is, no, Sharia law is actually much broader than just, you know, hand cutting and things like FGM. The conservative women Salafists in parliament had advocated for that. But in fact, I was told by Islamists, this is not even a part of Sharia law. So I'm wondering, this broader concept of Sharia law, which they defined as even being democratic and an end to dictatorship, an end to corruption, is that something new to their rhetoric post June 30th in Egypt? Thank you.
Yeah. So that's definitely something you saw much more of in the 90s and 2000s, broadening the conception of Sharia, where it's not just about specific Islamic laws, but Sharia could mean anything that's good counts as Sharia, that sort of thing. And that was a way also to kind of reassure people that Sharia isn't so scary. Everyone can support Sharia. And I think it's also fair. I shouldn't have given the impression earlier that it's just about cutting off of hands and the specific head punishments. But I think that is a part. We can debate how big that part is in Islamic law, but there's no doubting that it's part of the conversation. Now, I kind of raised the example of that poll for a reason. The Brotherhood to this day and either before or after the Arab Spring, has pretty much never publicly advocated for the implementation of the Had punishments. Now, there are a number of reasons for that, but generally that hasn't been part of their political program. But that's interesting because in some ways the Brotherhood is to the left of many Egyptians when it comes to the implementation of these punishments. So if we say that, you know, 80% or even 60% theoretically believe in the cutting off of the hands of thieves, the Brotherhood isn't even advocating that. So that shows you we're not just talking about conservative sentiment, we're talking about ideas that are more closely associated with Salafis. But Salafis, too, have also, I think, developed their rhetoric where they're trying to talk about Sharia and their political vision as more inclusive, that it includes anti-corruption and all of these things. But one thing I talk about in the book is this idea of the politics of stages. And it kind of feeds into this idea of the double discourse, if you will, of Islamist groups. Now, that's a kind of a big discussion on its own, but I think it's fair to say that there is, to some extent, this notion of politics of stages. And you even hear sometimes Muslim Brotherhood officials, when they're not very careful, expressing this to some extent, that there's a time for everything. When we're in the opposition, there's certain things that we focus on. If there's a political opening, then we have to focus on solidifying our power or our position in government. And maybe 20 or 30 years when society is ready and people are interested in the implementation of Islamic law and prepared for it, then we can start talking about that more seriously, right? And there's a real internal debate in Islamist organizations about the sequencing. And even in the so-called most moderate Islamist party in Tunisia, there is a conservative wing of the Ennahda party which does believe in the implementation of Sharia law. They're a minority, but they believe that over time things will move in their direction. And this kind of feeds into, I think, a conception that a lot of Islamists have. They kind of see freedom and Islamization going hand in hand because they have this idea of fitra, or human nature in English, that if people are free to do whatever they want, they're naturally going to gravitate towards Islam or towards Islamism even. And I think that leads to some problems in how they approach politics, but there very much is that sense. So whether in Tunisia or Egypt, this is one thing I heard time and time again, that as once we open up the political space, there will be a natural move in this direction. We don't have to impose it because the people will demand it.
Ilhan Kagri from the Muslim Public Affairs Council. I was just wondering, do you think that Salafism is making inroads within the government of Turkey? And second to that, you had mentioned that in Egypt what was going on is that the liberal parties really didn't have an agenda. They were basically against anything that was Islamic-based. And that, I think, happened in Turkey, and a lot of people are saying the reason Erdogan's party did as well as it did is because there, you know, was no opposition in the sense that they didn't really offer any alternative. So why do you think that is? Why do you think there's such a void in the message of the quote-unquote liberals in these countries?
Yeah, that's a very big and important question. Yeah, and it's not just in the Arab world. It's in a place like Turkey. So you would think that with Erdogan's overreaching and overstepping, that that would really provide an opportunity for the secular opposition, but they haven't been able to take advantage of that thus far. You know, so I think part of the problem is liberalism as an ideology, if you will, you know, isn't very well defined, certainly in the Arab world. And now we can even debate whether liberals in Turkey are liberal. I think it's better to call them secularists because their tradition with Atatürk, you know, starting 6 or 7 decades ago, was fundamentally illiberal. I mean, restricting personal freedoms, restricting the role of religion in public life. People couldn't wear the headscarf. So I think calling them liberal might not be the best thing. But yes, I think there is that challenge. What does it mean to have a secular program or a liberal program? What does liberalism mean to Egyptians and also to Egyptian voters? And I think early on, after Mubarak fell, it was very hard, and I actually talked to the founder. I remember one conversation, and I cite this in the book, one conversation with the founder of one of these new liberal parties, Mustafa Nagar, the founder of the Justice Party. He's he's a real liberal. I would consider him a real liberal. He does really believe in pluralism and basic freedoms for all. But he told me, Shadi, when we're campaigning out in the rural areas, I'm never going to use the word liberal because liberal has an association with lack of religion or atheism. So we have to find a different way to convey our ideas when we're talking to these more conservative rural voters. This is going to be a long-term generational project, though, to define more clearly what liberals stand for in the Arab world and in places like Egypt in particular. And so far they haven't, but that takes time. That takes time. And you hope that there will be a process of learning. And I think they all, but at the same time, there is this temptation, I think, to make it all about anti-Islamism. And that's where the polarization doesn't help. Because as long as you have the Islamist enemy, that's a much easier message for people, for your supporters in particular.
There was also another part of the question about Salafists in Turkey.
Salafis aren't a major force in Turkey and generally haven't been. That's actually one thing Turkey has going for it, that you don't have as much of this kind of Tea Party effect. Because Turkey has had a secular state system for so long, it's never been a hospitable environment for people with kind of ultra-conservative interpretations of Islamic law.
More questions? Up here in front, please.
Hi, I'm Lubna Sheikh. I'm a graduate student in George Washington University. I'd just like to know your take on the Gulf countries, Saudi Arabia and Emirates. They removed their ambassador, blaming Qatar for supporting Brother Muslimhood and demanding to end the support for Muslim Brotherhood. I just want to know, how do you see the relationships getting mended again, and how do you see the future
for them? Relationship between Qatar and Saudi Arabia?
Between GCC.
Yeah, so a big point of contention is the Muslim Brotherhood, and Qatar is allowing many Islamist opposition leaders to essentially set up shop and to operate outside of their territory. And, you know, as we've seen increasingly, Saudi Arabia sees the Muslim Brotherhood not just as a threat in Egypt, but as a threat regionally. And that's why there was just that terrorist designation last month, which was unprecedented. So now supporting the Brotherhood or even expressing sympathy for them, even in Saudi Arabia, is grounds for detention. So I don't see how this gets resolved, because it's very difficult now for Qatar to say, well, we change our mind and we're going to expel all the Islamist opposition leaders that we just allowed in like 5 months ago. And let's be honest too, I mean, Qatar has lost a lot of its popularity in the region, and especially liberals and secularists or non-Islamists in general see Qatar as supporting the people they don't like, the Muslim Brotherhood. But if they kind of push the Muslim Brotherhood out too, then pretty much everyone will dislike them. I mean, the one thing the Qataris have going for them is that Islamists still see Qatar as one of the last supporters they have in the region. It's pretty much Qatar and Turkey.
In back here, the second row.
Marwan, MEI. You said something really interesting earlier about the interpretation or how Islamists and secularists interpret American involvement. However, the conversation here revolves around American involvement and how it can be involved. If it has such a detrimental effect and it feeds into conspiracy theories, how do you think the U.S. can be involved to help their relationship and push the country towards democracy rather than just feed conspiracy theories?
Well, the kind of irony of this is the U.S. has actually been trying to disengage from Egypt. So despite that, let's say, reduction in involvement, the conspiracy theories are actually growing. So there doesn't seem to be a real correlation between disengagement and people liking you more, right? Which I think is an important lesson, really, of the last, you know, there's a lot of examples of this where we thought, for example, we'd wind down the war in Iraq, anti-American sentiment would decrease. It doesn't quite work out that way. So one thing I would suggest is clarity in policy. So the fact that the U.S. kind of, you know, they didn't want to call it a coup, but they were acting as if it was a coup in some ways, and this kind of, this back and forth and splitting the middle And I think that's really problematic, especially when we have clear legal provisions which say that if there is a military coup against a democratically elected government, we are legally required to suspend assistance. And when we won't even live up to our own law, I think that sends a detrimental message, not just to the Egyptians, but to many others in terms of, will we live up to our own stated commitments? I mean, what I would have liked to see, and it's probably too late now, is calling it a coup in clear terms, because it was, and then acting accordingly in terms of putting pressure on Sisi and the Egyptian military not to become Democrats overnight. That wasn't going to happen, but to at least be less repressive. And I think there was a moment early on, July, August, even September, where we could have pushed in a more positive direction if they felt we were serious, if they felt there was a real possibility that aid, and not just symbolically, that aid would be suspended for a sustained period of time, that might have helped them or pushed them to reconsider some of their repressive measures. And I think the longer we wait, the more limited our options are. So we're 9 months, 10 months into it. And I think I was hoping, and it's something I called for in an article I wrote a couple weeks ago, when you had the mass death sentence against 529 Muslim Brotherhood supporters, and Sisi then announcing his candidacy for president, we should have taken that as an opportunity to step back and say, this is not going in the right direction. It's not getting less repressive. Let's try to do the right thing. It might be 9 months late, but let's try to put some serious pressure to show the Egyptian military that there are going to be consequences if this kind of thing continues. But we never sent that clear message.
One of the messages sent was that the military was restoring democracy.
Yeah, I mean, looking back at that statement, it was very unfortunate, and it also turned out to be even more wrong than we would have thought. Not only did they not restore democracy, but they've actually been more oppressive than even I would have expected. I mean, I argued right when the coup happened that this is going to be pretty bad, because we know historically how coups work out, but I have to say, in some respects, I've been surprised at the sheer scale of repression.
I think we have time for about one more question up here.
My name is Sandy Kolb. You haven't said anything about the other Islamist power in the region, Iran. Is there a difference in terms of the political situation there and the role of the Islamists?
So I think there's a couple major distinctions. One is that Islamists came to power in Iran not through a democratic process, but through a revolution, and that changes things fundamentally. I mean, revolutionary actors or revolutionary regimes tend to be more radical. They're more aggressive, and you know, we saw that in the early years of the Iranian Revolution in terms of trying to eradicate their opponents in a very brutal way. So that's why I've never felt the Iran example is the most useful one, because for me, the democratic process part is key. You know, Egypt, the Muslim Brotherhood didn't come to power in Egypt through a revolution in the kind of traditional way of seizing power in a very kind of surgical way. No, they came to power through a series of elections. So another thing, of course, is that you know we have they're Shia and not Sunni. And I think we have to be careful not to draw too many parallels for that reason as well.
The book is Temptations of Power. Shadi, thank you for telling
thank
us
you for having
everything
me.
You've learned. And there are copies out for sale when you walk out the door.